3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I am in the studio with the full crew minus Emily today. So good morning, Inez, Alice, and Zakia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
Bria.
Sorry. Oh my gosh, we got so tripped up over names this morning that I think we're all in a tizzy.
What's in a name? What is in a rose as so sweet? That's Shakespeare. Yep.
Oh yeah. I'm pretty sure that's what Shakespeare wrote verbatim.
Yeah.
A famous line.
Yes.
And many have it tattooed.
It's a deep cut.
He wrote it for this show.
Yeah. He wrote it for this show. That's right.
Oh, yeah. William. Yeah. What have we got for the show today?
We have a full show, an exciting show, and maybe Alice wants to kick us off with a rundown.
Sure thing. The first thing on the agenda this morning is we're going to listen to an interview between the Giselle and James from Asia Pacific Currents with Nick McClellan, a researcher and journalist with Islands Business Magazine, for his analysis on the Puk-Puk Treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea, including a report of his experience at the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting held in Honiara in September 2025.
Cool. And then after that, Zakia, we're excited to hear your second interview.
Thanks. We hear from Mursel Sadat, former captain of Afghan women's football team. They are having a match, upcoming friendly match with UAE, on a story that inspired so many Australians that Afghan women's football team, after escaping Afghanistan, the players rebuild their lives here in Australia.
Yeah. But football has always stayed close to their hearts. So we're excited to hear this interview with Mursel. And after that, we are joined by Dave Sweeney, one of the co-founders of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and a current nuclear-free campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. And Dave's going to talk with us about progress on the campaign to get Australia to sign and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
And then lastly, we have an interview that is incredibly important and dear to me. It's an interview with Akshay Gori, who is the maker of a short film, Sister Mine, where Amarjeet is sent to Melbourne with a tragic mission to protect his family's honour by taking his sister's life, who has had an intercaste marriage. He instead finds love and warmth and conflict in the home of the woman he was meant to destroy. And Sister Mine is a powerful story of cultural pressure, patriarchy, femicide, but also sibling love and humanity winning over all of that. It is an incredibly courageous film. It is being heavily censored as well. Indian movies, particularly North Indian movies about femicide, about caste, about patriarchy, and going against that is like really, really brave. And Akshay is an amazing screenwriter and director who has made 8 other short films, and we'll be speaking to him about that.
Yeah, I'm really keen for this, especially because I think for folks who aren't tapped in, it can be maybe easy to ignore or neglect the fact that the caste system follows people into the diaspora.
Absolutely.
And it structures their lives in really violent ways.
Yeah.
So thanks, Inez. All right, we will be back to you shortly with the news headlines. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
I'm lucky and I'm clever. It's time again for Done By Law's legendary annual trivia night. We know you've been waiting, and yes, it is here. Grab some teammates and come along to catch up with like-minded folks in the community legal sector and beyond, and try your luck at taking home trivia glory. We're raising much-needed funds for the incredible 3CR. 3CR is 100% community controlled and relies on annual fundraising to keep its amazing local content on air. Friday 24th of October, 6:30 p.m. at the Richmond Town Hall. Tickets available via 3cr.org.au/done-by-law.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 9th of October. After 2 years of Israel's escalating genocidal attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has been accused of distorting facts and admitting the Australian government's complicity in the ongoing atrocities in his October 7th statement. Albanese remarks failed to acknowledge the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza while selectively mourning Israeli victims. In response, Palestinians and advocates in so-called Australia continue to demand sanctions and an end to the arms trade with Israel.
In related news, protesters will hold an emergency sit-in tomorrow to demand that the Australian government's so-called Sovereign Wealth Fund divests from Israel's genocide of Palestinians. The Australian Future Fund's latest public reporting revealed that it has dramatically increased its investment in Elbit Systems, Israel's biggest weapons manufacturer, surging its investment by more than 600%, while Elbit drones continue to kill thousands of Palestinians in Gaza.
Also this week, the Freedom for Tiller Coalition has accused the Israeli government of engaging in piracy, illegally intercepting and seizing its aid vessels in international waters as they attempt to breach the naval blockade of Gaza and deliver aid. Seven activists from so-called Australia, who were amongst the hundreds detained by Israel from the flotilla, have been released and deported to Jordan this week. The activists report being beaten, humiliated, and denied medical care while in custody of the Israeli Defence Force, and said they received shamefully poor assistance from the Australian government.
In other news, at least 24 people were killed and 47 injured when Myanmar's military junta dropped bombs from a motorised paraglider onto a peaceful protest in the Sagaing region earlier this week. The attack targeted a candlelight vigil amongst the Tadingyat festival, signifying protests against military conscription and the junta's plans for a December election. People who were at the vigil described scenes of devastation, and local human rights groups warned of the growing trend of paramotor attacks by the junta, urging regional governments to increase pressure on the illegitimate regime.
Also in headlines, a landmark federal court case testing the limits of free speech on criticism of Israel's genocide in Gaza will begin next Monday on Gadigal land in so-called Sydney. Now, University of Sydney academics John Keane and Nick Reamer are accused under Australia's Racial Discrimination Act for making public statements against Israel's genocide. They will be supported by a solidarity rally outside the court as their case becomes the first to test whether opposition to Zionism can be deemed hate speech.
In other news, it has been revealed this week that a charity behind a proposed 17-storey affordable housing tower in Nam's Greensboro is controlled by for-profit investment firm Tetris Capital, raising concerns about transparency and profit-making in Victoria's social housing sector. The Victorian branch of the charity, Together Housing, received more than $200 million in federal funding from the so-called Affordable Housing Project, despite being managed by directors from the finance firm. Housing advocates are calling for clarity on how taxpayer-subsidised developments like this will serve low-income tenants.
Finally, in headlines, the City of Melbourne Council will vote in December on a plan to expand its CCTV network by 100 cameras and grant council staff new powers to access footage for local and local law enforcement. If this expansion passes, council have also revealed the next phase will decide whether the encrypted artificial intelligence video analysis into the monitoring system. Legal and human rights experts have warned the proposal risks privacy breaches and misuse of surveillance data for people in Naram. This have been the news headline for Thursday, the 9th of October. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Last week, Australia and Papua New Guinea signed a new defence treaty known as the PUCPUC Treaty, the first alliance Australia has made since the treaty that was signed with the US 70 years ago. Now we're going to be listening to an interview from Giselle and James of Asia Pacific Currents last Saturday, October 4th, with Nick McLellan, a researcher and journalist with Islands Business Magazine, for his analysis, including a report of his experience at the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting held in Honiara in September 2025.
Can you give our listeners a brief rundown of the treaty and what its key provisions are?
Good morning. This is part of a broader agenda for successive Australian governments about building security relations with neighbouring countries. The treaty signed between the PNG cabinet and Australia includes key provisions that would allow Australian military forces to use bases in Papua New Guinea and vice versa, would allow potentially up to 10,000 Papua New Guineans to be eligible to serve in the Australian Defence Force, but it would also involve greater deployment of ADF personnel in partnership with the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. And it's basically designed, of course, to ensure that Australia, through this new treaty, is the partner of choice when it comes to security. And the obvious concern from Canberra, from Washington, from other Western countries, is the influence of China, not just in Papua New Guinea, but in many other Pacific Island countries.
So Albanese travelled to PNG in September to sign this treaty, but the PNG government was unable to have quorum. Can you talk a little bit about this delay and what was behind it?
Look, this came at the time of the Pacific Islands Forum in Honiara, and I was reporting as a journalist in Honiara. Albo had a very bad week that week. He travelled to Vanuatu. The meeting started on the Monday, but he spent the first couple of days in Vanuatu hoping to sign a treaty known as the Nakamal Treaty. This once again is about economic and security cooperation with Vanuatu. When members of the current coalition government got to actually read the text, there was a rebellion against finalising the treaty, particularly because of concerns that Australia would have an effective veto power. Although it's talked about consultation, it gives Australia veto over which companies might and countries might be involved in infrastructure projects. Once again, this is about concern that state-owned enterprises from China would be more involved in Vanuatu, and they're already very involved. The same sort of debate has been happening in Papua New Guinea. PNG for a long time has had a policy of friends to all, enemies to none. It has extensive economic and trade partnerships with China and Chinese companies, but also has signed security agreements with the United States and with Australia. And PNG's attitude is just signing on to this won't stop us having ongoing partnerships, be it with the Europeans, with the Chinese, with the Malaysians, with anyone else. But Canberra is very concerned that it basically wants veto, and many of the treaties that have been signed with Nauru, with Tuvalu and so on, essentially give Australia certainly consultation rights, but effectively a veto over partnerships, particularly on issues around ports, around roads, around wharves, infrastructures, airports and so on.
Well, China has been open about their opposition to this deal. How do you see this treaty in that case and in the context of all you've just talked about? How do you see this treaty fit in with the race for influence in the Pacific and then China's objectives?
Look, there is not just opposition from Beijing, but certainly within Papua New Guinea. leading figures in the PNG opposition have questioned whether this is a breach of sovereignty to have Australian and potentially other allied military forces operating from bases in Papua New Guinea. It's certainly a challenge to the long tradition of sort of non-alignment that PNG's upheld, despite historic ties about defence that go back to Australia, even pre-independence. You know, the Pacific Islands Regiment was, you know, Australian-led before independence. Australian troops have operated out of Igan Barracks and so on. Australia and the United States helped fund the Lombrum Naval Base up in Manus. You know, these ties are not new. This treaty really formalises it. The problem is that, firstly, China is a major economic power and will continue to be so until the middle of this century. That means that every country in the world, dare I say, including Australia, looks to China for commercial, trade, economic ties. And that's true for Papua New Guinea, just as it is for many other Pacific Island countries. Even the few countries that are aligned with Taiwan have significant PRC connections. The second problem, though, is, of course, the collapse of US primacy in the Western Pacific. You know, currently the Trump administration is about to put out a new national security statement with a greater focus on strength in the Western Hemisphere, in Canada, the United States, Central America, Latin America. And although China remains the main stalking horse, the main competitor for the United States in the Asia-Pacific region, you know, there are many, many commentators, and not just on the left, who recognise that the US is withdrawing to a certain extent from Southeast Asia and that China's power will continue to grow. And Australia desperately is trying to reinforce its security links to Pacific Island countries, but it's constantly undercut and will continue to be so there. Just one quick example. You know, at the recent Pacific Islands Forum, there was talk about a big program to have 100% renewable energy across the Pacific. Many countries use diesel oil to generate electricity, and Australia and other countries are talking about a big push around renewables for the Pacific Island countries. But I asked the Vanuatu climate minister at the forum, isn't China the biggest producer of solar technologies in the world? And he said, yes, well, of course, we'd like to have Australian standards, but we're going to buy Chinese equipment. So I think reality intervenes in this situation, and Australia is trying to shore up its relationship in a very top-down way with the military and security forces around the region without necessarily getting popular support for this shift.
One of the key issues that's come out of this treaty is sovereignty. With the provisions like the integrating of the two countries' militaries, what do you make of accusations that Papua New Guinea has effectively given up sovereignty to Australia?
Well, that's certainly a concern being raised by the opposition leader in Papua New Guinea, by leading academics. You know, you can look online at articles by Patrick Kaiku from UPNG, Michael Kabuni and others. They've raised exactly this concern. And that's because although they do want to have economic ties to Australia, you know, closest neighbour for Papua New Guinea, they do want to engage with the United States, with the European Union. They also want to engage with other BRICS countries, you know, Southeast Asian countries, China, Korea, Japan as well. You know, this idea that you have to have one sole partner. And I think one of the concerns amongst many leading people in the Pacific, not just in Papua New Guinea, is that Australia is pressuring people to integrate into Australian and, by extension, US foreign policy. You know, back in 2017, the Australian Foreign Policy White Paper actually said that we want to integrate Pacific Island countries' securities and economy into Australia's. And so this is back in the day, that was Malcolm Turnbull in those days. We've had successive prime ministers. And this Labor government is very much involved in this under Defence Minister Richard Marles, who hasn't seen a defence treaty he doesn't like. Pat Conroy, the Pacific Minister, is also Minister for Defence Industry, an interesting combination. And in the last cabinet reshuffle, he dropped the portfolio of international development aid. It's gone to Ann Arley, who ironically, given the focus on the Pacific, comes from Western Australia. So, you know, the aid program is increasingly being securitised in Australia, as some NGOs complain. And I think this is a real debate that's going on. And that's not reflected in the Australian media, partly because, you know, the Australian press pack is failing in its duty. You know, when Albanese came on the Wednesday of the Pacific Islands Forum, 2 days late, he held a press conference, yet Pacific Island journalists were excluded from that press conference. The door was literally shut in the face of journalists from Solomons, from PNG, from Tahiti, Fiji and other countries. Australian journalists were allowed in the room, Pacific journalists weren't. And there was an enormous angry reaction to that, that Australia talks a lot about being a member of the Pacific family, but when it comes to the crunch, the government doesn't want the hard questions. And I think our media is failing us by not listening to the range of perspectives on this question. There are many people who see Australia as a natural partner, given the geography and history, but many younger Papua New Guineans don't want to get trapped into US warfighting strategies, and they see the security treaty as part of that trend.
Just by way of conclusion, I wondered if you could tell us what you see as the long-term effects or consequences of the Puk-Puk Treaty and how it's being perceived in other parts of the Pacific and I guess the world more broadly.
Look, I think my problem is most people in the Pacific and I think in Australia don't really know what's in the treaty, haven't read it, and I think this is a problem that a lot of these treaties are negotiated behind closed doors without public consultation and extensive debate. You know, we saw that with AUKUS, which was rammed through. The ALP had one day to decide whether or not to back AUKUS under the Morrison government, and we're living with the consequences of this folly that we're supposed to be buying submarines from Britain, which is a joke. And I think there's a recognition, even in security circles, that this sort of policy making, which is behind closed doors, top down, is not working. And we've seen that in the case of Vanuatu. You know, senior members of the cabinet had signed off on the Nakamal Treaty, but as soon as people saw the text in the coalition government, they said, hang on, this is going to deny our sovereignty and control over key areas of infrastructure. And we'll see how that plays out in coming months. But there's the same debate going on in Papua New Guinea. You know, Australia still has to ratify the treaty, and I think over time it's part of a broader trend. But, you know, Australia is shoring up its defences against the interests of countries in the Pacific who don't agree with many of our policies, be it on, you know, nuclear weapons, for example, the fact that we're running B-52 bombers through Tyndall Air Base in the Northern Territory, half of which are capable of carrying nuclear weapons, the fact that from 2027, US nuclear attack and British nuclear attack submarines will be based in West Australia. The government says they're rotating, but they're going to be effectively based there. You know, Australia is more and more breaching the principles of the Treaty of Rarotonga for a South Pacific nuclear-free zone, in spirit, if not in the letter of the law. And I think there's a growing awareness amongst Pacific countries that while there are benefits from working with Australia as the largest neighbour, there are costs as well, and we're seeing that play out particularly with the failure of the Australian government to address Pacific concerns over climate change.
You've just been listening to an interview from last Saturday's Asia Pacific Currents show, where Giselle and James were joined by researcher and journalist Nick McClellan discussing the Puk-Puk Treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea. You can listen to Asia Pacific Currents every Saturday at 9 to 9:30 a.m. on 3CR or head to 3cr.org.au/AsiaPAC.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne.
If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
We are listening to 3CR Current Affairs Show. This morning we are sharing the story of the Afghan women's refugee football team, a group of remarkable women now based in Australia. They are preparing to travel to the United Arab Emirates for a friendly match, using football as a way to stand for women's rights and to show to the world the strength and resilience of Afghan women. Joining Mursel Sadat. Hi, Mursel Jan.
Hi, Zaki Jan. How are you?
I'm good. I'm going to start with the question: how significant is this friendly match in the United Arab Emirates for you and your team, both as athletes and an Afghan refugee living in Australia?
Well, it is a huge milestone achieved because after 4 years, we finally got something out of our advocacy, even though it's not what we wanted. But, hey, it's a great start, yeah? Yeah. And we will be joining the FIFA Unite Series. It's like a tournament between four countries in UAE, which is Chad, Libya, Afghanistan and the Saudi Arabia women's national team. It is great to have the stage back, the platform back, and again to showcase to the world the talents of Afghan women. Even though we are refugees with open wounds, still the trauma to heal from, but we're doing it for our sisters back home.
Oh, that's great. How did your team connect with the organizers in the UAE and make this match possible?
So this was like an ongoing advocacy that we had from 3 years ago. It started off as us collecting signatures and reaching out to FIFA to give the recognition of a national team from exile to the Afghan women's national soccer team, because as you know, the Taliban aren't allowing women to play sports or to education or anything literally at this point. And this advocacy was not only for us, but for all Afghan women outside Afghanistan who are very talented, but they just need that platform that they have lost for years. And finally, this year, FIFA decided to respond to us, take action, and all this tournament is organized by FIFA itself, and the Afghan women's refugee team is managed directly by FIFA. So we had our trials that more than 80 players joined, about 26 in Australia and other two training camps in UK, which we had players from across Europe and Italy and UK joining there. And 23 players made it to the final squad, with the head coach being Paulin, a very, very talented coach from Scotland. And we will be playing all this game under the management of FIFA.
Oh, that's great. You mentioned about the training. If you could tell us how Afghan women training this, like from Australia.
Yeah, so after the ID camp that we had, We have been training with one of the coaches who is from FIFA based in Melbourne. And we're trying to build that consistency in the training. And, you know, it's very hard to come after 4 years and train at a national level. And the time is very limited because we only had about a month or more than that to train at the gym and on the field to reach that strength that we need. But time is never limiting Afghan women. You know that. They're all lionesses and they will do whatever it takes to win and to show the world that we're not weak. We know that there are many people waiting for our loss, especially the Taliban and their supporters. But I know that there are our community members and the world who are supporting women, and they will never disappoint us.
That was great. As you're preparing for this game, what messages are you hoping to send to the world about the rights of Afghan women and resilience of Afghan women?
So we want to say that nothing is impossible, because when we started this advocacy, everyone was saying that, oh, it's very hard to convince FIFA. It will not be possible because, like, you know, the member of federation, which is the Afghan Football Federation, is not allowing you guys. But resilience is there, and it helps you to achieve whatever you want. And what I want a message to deliver to the world is, so don't forget about women of Afghanistan. They have a lot of talent, and we still have a lot of Afghan women across the world who were not eligible to join this camp or due to the restrictions on the travel based on their visas that they're holding, they were not able to join this team. So support us in this way. Vote yes for an Afghan women's national team from exile. So next year, and the year after, it won't be just a refugee team, because that's not enough. That's not what we want. Although a great milestone, a great first step, but we need the world to support us into having the national team, having the platform, giving the chance to the women of Afghanistan to represent themselves. And I just want to tell the women inside Afghanistan that they're the true heroes in this story, and we will do anything in our capacity to share their stories and share their voices in the world.
Thank you, Mursaljan. The last question is, beyond football, what do you hope the international community understand about the challenges and hopes for Afghan women through the participation in this tournament?
Well, it is always beyond football, because it has never been only about the game. It has always been about advocacy, about fighting for what is right and for fighting with the challenges. And, you know, the stones that were thrown on our way, we used it to build a bridge to reach our goals. And I want the world to realize that women of Afghanistan are not giving up ever. They're still fighting, and it's just beyond the pitch. It's about our sisterhood. It's about the unity that we have, and it's not actually even about our nationality as Afghans. As long as you're a human being, you know that human right is a right to have, not a right to be given. And all those women in Afghanistan, they have the right to have their basic rights. It shouldn't be banned on them. And I want the international community to come together as a united force for change, for the future of women inside Afghanistan who have been banned from their basic human rights for 4 years now.
Thank you, Mursaljan, for being in this show and giving update on how you are going with the game. And do you have any last messages to share on the air today?
Thank you so much, Zakia John. I just want to thank you and Rajit 3CR for always supporting the team and spreading awareness about the things that are happening. And the power of media is great. And I just want to tell others to use it the positive way.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a beautiful day.
You too, Zaki John. Thank you.
That was Mursel Sadat, the captain of the Afghan women's refugee football team. Their upcoming match in the UAE is more than just football. It is a message of courage, equality, and the ongoing fights for Afghan women's rights. You're listening to the 3CR Current Affairs shows. Stay with us for more stories that gives voice to change.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Do you have a fine you're worried about? If you are struggling to pay a fine, there can be ways to help you deal with it. You may be able to get your fine lifted or reduced where you are experiencing difficult life circumstances, such as family violence, mental health challenges, disability, homelessness, or drug or alcohol dependency. If you have fines from not paying toll roads, you may also be able to get the fine waived if you're experiencing financial or other hardship. Speak to a community lawyer or financial counsellor to get advice on your options. You can find your local community centre on the Federation of Community Legal Centres website, fclc.org.au. You can find a financial counsellor by calling the National Debt Helpline on 1800 007 007. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Environmental Film Festival is back, running from the 16th to the 23rd of October across Melbourne, Footscray, Fitzroy and Elwood. Enjoy Australia's premier environmental cinema showcase with 23 films, 14 premieres, 4 talks and 2 community gatherings, all exploring ideas of urban living, nature and beyond. Plus celebrate the team's 15th year with a very special anniversary party. In this time of climate crises, reconsider the world around you and experience how environment is everywhere with the Environmental Film Festival 2025. Tickets on sale now at environmentalfilms.org.au.
Presented by Environmental Films Australia, a 3CR supporter.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
I'm lucky and I'm clever.
It's time again for Done By Law's legendary annual trivia night. We know you've been waiting, and yes, it is here. Grab some teammates and come along to catch up with like-minded folks in the community legal sector and beyond, and try your luck at taking home trivia glory. We're raising much-needed funds for the incredible 3CR. 3CR is 100% community controlled and relies on annual fundraising to keep its amazing local content on air. Friday 24th of October, 6:30 p.m. at the Richmond Town Hall. Tickets available via 3cr.org.au/done-by-law.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:39 in the morning, And I'm going to do a little bit of a weather check. So today we are expecting a maximum temperature of 21 degrees Celsius, a minimum of 12. And according to the Bureau of Meteorology, it is 14.1 degrees now, feels like 10.9. But honestly, when I was riding in, it felt pretty toasty. So I'm loving this weather, except for the hay fever, which is killing me. Expect up to 1 mm of rain today. It's going to be partly cloudy, but for the most part, I think it's going to be a pretty nice day. And now we are heading to our next interview for the day, which is with Dave Sweeney. And Dave is one of the co-founders of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, and a current nuclear-free campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. And Dave joins us to discuss progress on the campaign to get Australia to sign up and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, also known as the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty. The 27 Agreement is the first international legally binding treaty that is designed to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading towards their total elimination. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Priya.
Thanks very much for joining us. So I guess to get started, I wanted to ask if you could give us a brief recap of the purpose of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and its relationship to, or, you know, development in response to progress or lack thereof on the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which, of course, is a much, much older instrument.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is how the TPNW, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, came about, because in the early part of this century, at the start of the 2000s, there was a big review conference of the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it was like the NPT enshrines civil nuclear power and civil nuclear industry for countries around the world, but says you can't have nuclear weapons. But the nuclear weapon states are required to enter into good faith disarmament negotiations, but they never have. So there was this review conference, and there was a lot of pressure put on to activate the part about, okay, those of you with nuclear weapons, you've got to get serious about getting rid of them. And the meeting met for 6 weeks and couldn't even agree on an agenda. It was a complete and utter circus and debacle. And there was a group of us that had been watching this, had been working to try and elevate pressure and expectation for some movement on nuclear abolition, and thought this just isn't working. We need a mechanism that actually just really focuses on weapons, that doesn't muck around and just says these weapons are they're weapons of mass and indiscriminate murder. They don't distinguish between civilians and combatants. They are in every way vile. They have no strategic utility and they're profoundly anti-human. And so let's set about, and we looked at how people had used mechanisms in other areas, chemical and biological weapons, landmines, cluster munitions. And one thing they had in common, Priya, was they all said, let's ban these things. And so we set to get an international legal ban on nuclear weapons. And then that then shrinks the space. It changes the way we talk about these weapons. It turns them from so-called elements of defence into just what they are, bullying weapons of mass murder. And we can start to shrink the space and get rid of these weapons. So that was the profound focus of ICAN. Let's get a legal ban on nuclear weapons. It kicked off in 2007, got a treaty up, which was supported in the UN and became the International Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons in 2017. ICAN was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize that year. And then with international agreements, you need to have a minimum of 50 countries that come on board and are formally signed, been through all their domestic procedures, and then it enters into force. And that happened with ICAN in January 2021. The Treaty for the on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force. And now we're talking here now, and as of last month, just a week ago, Ghana signed up, and now fully one half of the nations in the world are formally on board with this treaty ban, and it is really gathering momentum, and it needs to, because we're in dangerous days, and this is probably one of the best navigators that we've got to get to chart a course to a peaceful and a livable future.
And out of the many, many countries in the world, it is a very small number of countries that actually do have a nuclear arsenal or are preparing, you know, to develop, you know, are on track to develop nuclear capabilities. I'm wondering how many of those have signed on to this treaty, and maybe tied into that, can you talk about some of the outcomes of the third meeting of states parties to the TPNW in March this year and some of the priorities of signatories there? Because I understand that parties to the treaty met at the UN headquarters in New York earlier in the year.
Yeah, that's right. So your first question about nuclear weapon states. So there's around 200 countries in the world. There's less than 10 that have nuclear weapons. And those nuclear weapon states are the five members of the UN Permanent Security Council, so the US, the UK, France, Russia, China, and then there's India, Pakistan, Israel and North Korea. They're the nuclear weapon states in the world. They're the pariah states, the terror states that threaten the existence of the world every day, with the holding and possessing and threatening to use weapons that could end everything that ever was, is and could be in a day. So they're the crew. Against the whole realm of the world, it's not big, but against the danger they pose to the world, it's huge. None of them have signed the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. All of them are to varying degrees either indifferent or actively, virulently hostile to the treaty and put pressure on their client states to oppose it as well. Despite that, like I said, half the world's nations have signed on to the treaty and it is progressing and growing. Absolutely needs to, because we're in a time of real tension with nuclear weapon states in hot wars, trade wars and dangerous posturing. And as you say, there was a meeting, came together at the UN in March of this year, where there was the third meeting of states parties. So for the third year in a row, all the states that have signed or are like on the track to formal ratification of this treaty met at the UN. They met there for a few days, like 3 to 7 March this year. And for outcomes of that, well, there were quite a few. They did some really advanced and important work about an international trust fund for victim assistance and environmental remediation. So how do you support communities and how do you heal a country that's been impacted by nuclear testing? They had an expanded mandate and terms of reference for a working group on ways to grow the treaty, what they term universalisation, how to grow it and get it more adopted around the world. Importantly, they set the date for the first formal review conference. So moving from a meeting of state parties to a formal review of how we're tracking, what needs to go better, and how do we continue to advance this. And that's going to happen the tail end of next year, Priya, like late November to early December in 2026. And South Africa, who's been a really strong supporter of this treaty, South Africa will be the president for that review conference, which is really positive. That meeting also came up with a really strong political declaration. And the important part about that declaration, it's hardly surprising that the group of nations that have signed on to ban nuclear weapons put out a statement at the end of their meeting saying we don't like nuclear weapons. So that happened. But the important part was that they put out a really crisp and strong rejection of that whole notion of deterrence. Like people say, oh, well, you know, now that some of them have got them, we need to have them sort of thing. And that's been used as a justification for the unjustifiable for too long. And it was front and centre countered. They set up some really good frameworks and mechanisms for consultations about how to improve gender and all ability access and input into discussions and how to consider other cohorts and demographics. And they, I suppose, that, you know, the take-home thing is they help to really consolidate and embed this framework that's seen half the world's nations formally adopt the treaty. So, you know, that was a very positive. Unlike the NPT review committee 20 years earlier, that was a complete, effectively waste of time. This was extremely positive. It was outcomes focused. It was constructive. And there's a real sense amongst the countries that are driving this, Priya, about a sense of urgency and a sense of like, we mightn't have nuclear weapons, but we would be impacted and affected by it, and we have every right and we are going to take every action to get rid of them.
I mean, I think when you touch on that that point of deterrence as well, and the, you know, falsifying effectively the legitimacy of that argument, I think it's really important to, you know, be direct about how nuclear weapons pose an existential threat to everyone. It is not something that will have restricted impacts in a particular area, which we should be concerned about as well, but rather that once somebody presses the button, there is going to be a guaranteed response and latency periods, but still that it's going to impact everyone. I was wondering if you talk about really the scale of existential threat that we're facing, and especially in relation to some of those regional conflicts, including, you know, Israel's regional aggression and the United States, maneuvering in various kinds of trade and sanctions wars at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, you've absolutely hit the nub of it. There are two existential threats to this planet. There's lots of problems. There's lots of complexities and threats and things that impede and can imperil people. But there are two existential threats to the planet. And one is unchecked climate change, and the other is the use of nuclear weapons. And one erodes our chances every day, and the other could end our chances in a day. And both of them worsen each other, and both of them need urgent address. And in relation to nuclear weapons, they are an identified, profound, established and unavoidable existential threat. Like their use would not be limited. Every model, every scenario of nuclear exchange sees elevated responses and increased use of nuclear weapons. It's a very bad scenario. And detailed modelling of even what you would call a limited nuclear exchange confined to a geographical region, and there's been different options modelled, and particularly one that's modelled is a small-scale nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, very credible scenario. And even a small one means displacement, dust, ash, disturbance into the upper atmosphere, which causes dramatic climate change, temperature drop, agricultural and aquacultural impacts. 2 billion people starve. That's before the people who die and the people who fry. 2 people later, like you said, latency period, 2 billion people starve. Now, that is limited, and where the most of the scenarios say that it doesn't get limited. So it's really bad stuff. The arsenals are expanding. Trust and transparency is contracting. Like I said, we've got nuclear states in hot wars, trade wars and posturing. And the doomsday clock, which is an independent measure of humanity's threat of, you know, disaster, existential disaster, is as close to midnight as it ever has been. It's closer to midnight than it was in the coldest part of the Cold War. And this is even more compounded now, Priya. It's more concerning now because there are extra factors that weren't in the bipolar world, the USA, USSR stare-out world of the Cold War. Now we've got non-state actors, we've got terrorism, we've got cyber attacks and drones, we've got aging missile command and control systems, we've got the devolving of nuclear weapons decision-making to AI. It's a critical time to have a pause and a breath and a pathway to peace. And we see that TPNW offers the best chance to get rid of our worst weapons. And so it's sort of, you spoke about a regional conflict, and like there are horrendous regional conflicts, we all know, but like nuclear weapons exchange would be a global Gaza. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what we're looking at. We've got conflicts, as you have said, here with massive posturing over Taiwan and China and US containment strategies and the whole AUKUS subs stuff. We've got conflicts with 2 nuclear weapon states, well, 3 actually, Russia, North Korea, Israel, nuclear weapon states involved in hot firing wars now. Chances for escalation. We've got all of those nations increasing their nuclear arsenals, bristling and a real sense of isolationism, a retraction from the sort of sense of international, much abused term, but international rules, codes, norms, behaviours, that sort of trust that we need, that sort of sense of looking back from space and seeing one shared fragile planet, that's breaking down into armed camps. Mm. And those are armed camps and nuclear armed camps. And we've got to really step up our efforts now. And countries like Australia have a really important role in stepping up efforts to put in that pause, to put in that circuit breaker, to make a plea for humanity.
Absolutely. And I think as we see also the rise of further right, far right political power, that also, you know, there's the geopolitical concern as well of how those isolationist and protectionist tendencies then also feed into really concerning multilateral suicide pacts effectively that, you know, can really result in, I guess, you know, annihilation in the worst case. And so I'm glad that you've drawn attention to all of this and how no conflict involving nuclear weapons can really be considered regional. Now, turning to Australia's responsibilities, of course, Australia is a non-signatory of the TPNW. Can you talk about Australia's engagement with the treaty thus far and the urgency of signing and ratification as a non-nuclear weapons state, but nonetheless a close partner of some of those states that are?
Yeah, absolutely. Australia has, well, the former government, the coalition government, was not interested in the treaty, didn't even acknowledge when ICAN was the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for its effort in advancing the treaty, so there wasn't even an acknowledgement of that. It's quite extraordinary. The current government, Labor, in opposition in December 2018 in its national conference in opposition, adopted that in government, after consideration of factors in government, Labor will sign and ratify the treaty. That's a very important step. It's one that hasn't yet been actioned. It's one that we're calling on. There's another ALP conference in July 2026, and ICAN and our many partner groups are calling on Labor to deliver on that clear and now long-standing commitment to sign and advance the TPNW. What's happened since Labor took office is that there's been a change in language. The language that's used in international forums is more supportive of nuclear weapons abolition. It is Labor has sent a formal parliamentary observer to the three meetings of state parties, not at the table as a signatory, but in the sort of outer ring as an observer. And that's a good sign and important. There's been some changes in UN votes, like oppositions move to abstention and abstentions move to yes in some significant votes around nuclear weapons matters and rhetoric and positioning. But the real sort of test and the real urgency hasn't been realised yet by Labor. They've been dragging their heels, even though the majority of the Labor caucus and cabinet are personally pledged to supporting this, even though Prime Minister Anthony Albanese moved the motion and spoke powerfully to it at the 2018 conference and subsequently, they haven't still acted. And that's clearly because of pressure from America, who certainly don't want this to happen. Mm. So our view is that this is more important than ever as Australia sort of unbelievably advances the deeply flawed AUKUS pact. It's more important than ever that a project that is built around nuclear-powered submarines has clear guardrails in so that there's not mission creep, that this then becomes, well, we've accepted nuclear power, so we may as well accept nuclear weapons. That's the next step. We need to put a signature on that page to stop Australia sort of eroding its position into one of either acquiescence or enabling our AUKUS partners, both of whom are nuclear weapon states, mm-hmm. to deploy ever-increasing nuclear material and potentially weapons, either on ships, on subs or planes, using our waters and our land and bases on our country. We have the right to say no. We have the absolute right to know, and we should put guardrails in that send a signal well and truly from Wagga to Washington, from Birdsville to Beijing, that Australia does not accept, support, condone or in any way facilitate nuclear weapons. So that's what the call is, and we're reaching out and working with a whole range of partners. We've got multiple partners across Australia in unions, in Red Cross, in the AMA, in faith community, in so many areas. There's so many groups that are supportive of this, and we're all asking them to elevate this issue amongst the many other worthy issues they work on, to elevate this and grow expectation on Labor to deliver something that every poll shows the majority of Australians want. And the majority now of the world is saying, let's go there.
Yeah. And look, we already know that the consequences of nuclear testing, nuclear storage, even non-weapons and non-military related functions have already caused so much damage across so-called Australia, and of course, predominantly affecting Aboriginal people on, you know, their own country. So I think there is another imperative here as well to make sure that we resist this. Now, I understand that ICAN is, continuing to run this campaign, and we will share information in our show notes about how folks can get involved in an upcoming meeting. But look, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to talk us through this. I think it's a really important issue. It's something that we need to be more alarmed about, and appreciate all your work.
Thank you very much, Priya. Really, really appreciate the opportunity and the depth of the questioning. Really good. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:01 in the morning, and that was a conversation with Dave Sweeney, who is one of the co-founders of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and the current nuclear-free campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. And Dave joined us to discuss progress on the campaign to get Australia to sign and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Also known as the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty, the 2017 agreement is the first of its kind, designed to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading towards their total elimination.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
We're back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I'm now going to hand it over to Inez, who is joined by a guest in studio.
Thanks so much, Priya. And now we are joined by Akshay Gori, the maker of the short film Sister Mine, where Amarjeet is sent to Melbourne with a tragic mission to protect his family's honour by taking his sister's life, who has had an inter-caste marriage. He instead finds love and warmth and conflict in the home of the woman he was meant to destroy. Sister Mine is a beautiful story of cultural pressure, sibling love, and humanity winning over hate. Akshay Gori is a screenwriter and director who has made over 8 short films, both fiction and non-fiction. And again, if you need support, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. Now, the caste system in India has existed in some form for over 2,000 to 3,000 years. It's a social hierarchy that's rigid, passed down through families and lineages, and dictates the profession the person can work, as well as most aspects of their social lives, including who they can marry. While it has its roots in Hinduism and its traditions, Nearly all Indians today identify or are assigned a caste, regardless of their religion. You're born into it, you can't change it. These have existed for centuries, and British rule really seek to further cement this to enforce categorization, dehumanization, and violence. The caste system, Varna, is rigid, hierarchical, birth-based, with roots in Hinduism, and informs the current classifications of the population of India today with this majority ruling. General caste, sometimes called forward caste, with Brahmins being at the very top, called the priests or the teachers, along with the most privileged caste, make up around 30% of the population, according to a 2025 survey. The Varna system has four classifications, Brahmins at the very top, and we have scheduled caste Dalit and scheduled tribe Adiyavasi. These are the most oppressed socioeconomic groups at the bottom. They often exist outside of the caste system, with Dalits also being known as the, quote, untouchables, where you are essentially not allowed to see them, touch them, share a meal, share water, share location. Dalit meaning untouchable and Adiyavasi meaning original inhabitants also can carry significant stigma and history, but also some groups have preferred to reclaim these terms. But some also prefer more constitutional terms of scheduled caste or scheduled tribe. This make up around 16% and 8% of the population, according to a 2011 census. Then, everything in between, basically, is what India classifies the other backward classes. So basically, if you're not at the very top, or you're not a scheduled tribe or a scheduled caste, you are other backward class, who are also socioeconomically marginalized and disadvantaged. People who are assigned the other backward classes are often descendants of India's indigenous communities, which further amplifies its discrimination. They make up around 41% of India's population, according to a 2026 survey. Despite post-independent constitutional rights and affirmative action, caste violence has become India's new normal. Dalits, particularly Dalit women, experience daily horrors that are truly unconscionable, from a Dalit child being killed by their teacher for simply touching a water pot, to being kidnapped to university and tortured by upper caste students, to being lynched for accidentally walking through an upper caste area. These are not just personal. These are systemic, deeply ingrained, and difficult to receive criminal justice trials, if they are even taken seriously, if they are even reported at all. While they say there's constitutional rights and affirmative actions, this is not always practice. We also see the most caste-based violence in BJP, Hindu nationalist, majority-run states such as Uttar Pradesh with the highest level. However, caste systems can look different in different states such as Tamil Nadu and Punjab in India. There's also a Punjab in Pakistan, we always forget about that. In Punjab in India, Brahmins don't necessarily hold the same social control in the same way. As Punjab is mainly an agricultural society, those who own the most land, or jats as they're called, hold the most social control. There's a sentiment in Punjab that caste doesn't exist here as it's not really a Hindu majority state. But all chief ministers of Punjab have been from jat backgrounds. Most political parties in Punjab have had a jat leader. They also own most of the agricultural land. And even when attempts have been made to redistribute land ownership to more caste oppressed groups, jats often use bribes, social force, social control, to buy proxy votes. And when you're economically disadvantaged, you can't really say no. Nearly all landless labourers come from the scheduled caste backgrounds. And while people say caste doesn't matter, we don't see it in Punjab. Caste remains a vital aspect of marriage, often protected by marrying only within your caste groups. And Dalit Sikhs often reporting facing abuse and discrimination at the hands of Jat Sikhs, here as well as in the diaspora. Most people, especially those from more privileged or quote-unquote upper castes, only date within their caste, have majority friends from their caste, mainly state they would refuse to be neighbours with someone of a lower caste, and marry only within their caste. With this very brief foundation knowledge that we could speak about for a long time, let's look at how it interplays with patriarchy, family, conformity, femicide, and violence. Thanks so much, Akshay, for joining us. And I know that your film, Sister Mind, opens up a scene of the patriarch of the family saying, "Nothing can help now. I wish she had died just as soon as she was born. Give me poison. End this once and for all." It's a really sharp, painful line that holds the weight of 1,000 cuts and generational honour and femicides in this one sentence. Why choose this opening scene and this dialogue to open the film with?
Thanks for having me on the show, Ines. And actually, thanks for that very well-detailed introduction about caste. A lot of people do not know enough about it or just ignore it. And thanks for bringing up that horrific and very well-detailed analysis. As for now, the opening of my film, it is, as you've said, I think it is because of all of those reasons that I put that line at the very opening. It does say pretty much everything about how honor is defined in our societies, which are extremely patriarchal. It is defined by control, especially over women and over all the marginalized. And I think that is why that opening was very important. There is also a narrative reason for that as well. So for a 20-minute short film, it is very important to establish the stakes right at the front, right up front. So I did try to do that in the first minute and a half of the film to let the audience know what the film is about.
Yeah, amazing. I think also being from a Punjabi background and living, experiencing the gender-based violence, it was a really moving an important watch, and it was really, what also really struck me is when they go to the son and they say, if you have any shame, you would bring back your sister's severed head. That's so graphic and intense, and saying only then you can save your dad's honor, only you can clean up her mess now. So much of, you know, families and societies only seem to praise masculinity and honor when it's enacted through the violence against women. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it is horrible that that is true. And I think the primary reason for it is to hold on to power, to hold on to the already established hegemony of men, upper caste men especially, but yep, men in general as well, dominating and controlling, like I said, women's bodies, their autonomy, their agency, and them wanting to be, you know, decision makers for anything and everything in life. I think it stems from that, that a certain kind of trait is cherished in our society, which is very, very toxic. And so there are both sides of it. Of course, men growing up as well kind of have to conform to that toxic trait. And it is very, very dangerous and very damaging for them as well. But much, much more damaging it is for women, for all the other genders, and for people from the so-called backward or scheduled class.
Yeah, I really appreciated how it's really a masterclass in the control of tone and tension. You know, I found myself like holding my breath, unsure of what's about to happen, and then being really comforted by their relationship, and then, you know, bringing in a perfectly timed instrumental to kind of release that breath. It was so clearly like thought out in every single beat. But what was the tension that you kind of wanted to display between all the relationships and really help the audience feel that?
Yeah, thank you for that comment.
That's okay. It's true.
Thanks. Basically, I wanted to examine the tension primarily between the relationship of the brother and the sister, the brother who has been sent to have to murder his sister, whether or not he wants to do it or will be able to do it or will ever do it is a different question altogether. So it's primarily an exploration of their relationship, which growing up for them has been very close. They have been pretty close. They actually do love each other as siblings. Then there is another layer of exploration of relationships, which is between this brother and his brother-in-law. the husband of the sister who is from the scheduled caste. Mm. And how the brother, irrespective of his love for his sister, how he still looks down upon the husband, how he blames the husband in his own head for things going sour in his family. So I wanted to explore those tensions. Apart from that, again, from a narrative filmmaking point of view, I also wanted to explore elements of the thriller genre within a broader drama genre. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you definitely feel those influences. And knowing how close their relationship was, and even though he can try to like reconcile and really hold his like family's honor and try to mediate all this within that, how he still looks down on the husband. I think that's a really important point. Yeah. And particularly when we're first introduced to the sweet sister, we see a range of well taken care of plants, protest posters on her walls in her place in Melbourne, and she still remembers the way that he takes his coffee. What do you think this tells us about their relationship and her?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for noticing all of that, all that production design. I think it proves that it works.
Yes.
In the film. So basically, it tells you up front when they first meet that they have been very close. The sister has always taken care of him. She's the elder one. And especially in our societies, being elder becomes, you know, a whole new role as well. She's almost been a mother to him. Almost. So there is that closeness still there. And even the brother reciprocates it, even though he is tentative because he is weighed down under the task that he's supposed to do. But there is that closeness. The other thing through the production design that I wanted to elaborate was the fact that she has kind of broken away from the chains that had been holding her back while she was growing up, and she has become this woman who will say, who will speak up for herself, who will stand for herself and make her decisions on her own.
Yeah. The breaking away is so important, and to be able to show that through the set design and little things, but I think particularly around how much she looks after him, and how parentified, yeah, the eldest daughter role is. And going back to their, you know, inter-caste marriage, there's such a misconception that caste only really exists in, like, Hindu-majority countries or states, and that it just simply does not exist in Punjab and the diaspora. That everybody gets along, and it's not based in the Hindu-based runner system that it's rooted in. There's so many reasons for this, but yeah, do you want to talk us through why? Why is it that particularly in Punjab, it's just completely, we're fine, everybody gets along.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing it up, because I've been getting a lot of these comments by people who are saying, oh, it does not exist in Punjab, it happens in Haryana or Rajasthan or Uttar Pradesh. Well, I think it's very, very easy to always shove the blame on the next person and be in denial about what one does themselves. I think it is because of that. But more importantly, I think it is because denial is a form of privilege.
Absolutely.
Someone in privilege, someone who wields power, will always say that they are doing nothing wrong whatsoever. And I think that is a classic case that has been happening here. So unfortunately, caste has gone well beyond the boundaries of Hinduism and that particular religion. It has become the reality of entire South Asia and also the diaspora all across the world. And 750 AD was when Islam came to India. It did not have caste back then. But very quickly, even Islam in India and in the entire subcontinent started having these castes. Sikhism was born out of the need for not having caste, born out of the need for equality. And yet, it has those castes. When I go to Punjab, there are people from the scheduled castes who still live in segregated areas.
Yep.
They cannot enter the fields of the upper caste people, as you've already pointed out, and they get brutalized if they drink from the same well, or if you know, they touch the powerful absolutely people. So it's absolutely appalling. And what's worse is this very privileged ignorance of the fact,
yep,
that it does not exist.
Yeah, I think sometimes with Punjab, particularly in India, it's if you come from like Sikh and Punjab, like farming families, or you're living in non-scheduled caste areas, there is such an apathy where you say it doesn't exist. I remember speaking to some people about that and just talking about their lives in Punjab, and then they were saying, oh yeah, no, that doesn't happen. But when the cleaner comes over, we use a different sponge, we use different plates, we use different forks. She's not allowed to sit on the furniture. Right, but caste doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Sure. But I sit on the floor with her and I talk to her. Okay. I think that's hard because, like, yes, in Punjab, in Hindu majority India, you are oppressed, but you're still North Indian and you're still within the caste structure more privileged. And it feels like sometimes really hard to acknowledge that. And I know that even with the resurgence of Bhangra music and, you know, we hear every single song is like jut, 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 everything.
Yes.
But because it's not like Brahmins, priests are not, have the same standing in Punjab when it's agricultural land and all the landowners are jut, it really, that's how it amplifies.
Absolutely. So there is that very important intersectionality between caste and class as well.
Yeah.
And in the different religions as well, there is that intersectionality with caste. And I think it is very important that we try and understand how that works. I think there is one other thing that I would also like to point out. It is that caste system is very, very much like the racist system, racism. And yet, unfortunately, the world has not spoken enough about it. The people who have been oppressed by it have been trying to speak out, but they haven't been allowed to. Yes, they are fighting for it, and they must continue, but everyone else must also come in and speak up about it, because one in four people in the entire world face this.
Yeah. And it was only recently where Hari Om, who was a Dalit man, was accidentally looking for his wife, who's a sweeper, and wanders into a village of a more privileged caste, and they lynch him,
yep,
for accidentally simply walking through. And if you go on Dalit history on Instagram, you'll see horrific daily horrors. And you know, I know we're speaking about this from a relatively privileged position right now, but I'm curious to know how the festival and premiere circuit has been. Because one, you're making a movie about femicide, then you're making a movie about caste violence, and then also from a Punjabi North Indian farming family. It's honestly so important and so courageous, but it's not lost on me that most likely screenings, actors yourselves, would be censored and or attacked for even making this, let alone showing this. So how are you getting the film out there?
Yeah, that's a very, very tough question to answer. At the moment, thankfully, the film is doing relatively well at the festival circuit, and it is traveling to international film festivals, playing on October 12th in Toronto at the South Asian Film Festival there up next, and it will hopefully go to a few more festivals. That's only one route, however. I've had a few private screenings of it here in Melbourne, in Kolkata, and in Rohtak, which is my hometown. And there has been very polar opposite reaction to it. I have had a lot of support, a lot of love. And at the same time, I've had comments that this is absolutely untrue and this is defamation. And why are you even making this film and all of that? So it's been kind of a tough journey. After the festival circuit, I do want to release it on my own small little YouTube channel. I have a few of my previous short films on that channel as well, and I would like to add this to the channel. It's the channel is in my own name. It is Akshay Gouri, G-O-U-R-I, and I would request all the listeners and you to check it out, please.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Akshay. We'll put that all in our show notes. And that's Akshay Gouri, G-O-U-R-I, the maker of the short film Sister Mine, where the sister has an intercaste marriage and the brother is sent to Melbourne to essentially kill his sister. But it's a movie about cultural pressure, and thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are coming up to the end of our show. But before we leave you, we want to remind you that the Environmental Film Festival is coming up from next week. So here's another reminder about that.
Environmental Film Festival is back, running from the 16th to the 23rd of October across Melbourne, Footscray, Fitzroy and Elwood. Enjoy Australia's premier environmental cinema showcase with 23 films, 14 premieres, 4 talks and 2 community gatherings, all exploring ideas of urban living, nature and beyond. Plus celebrate the team's 15th year with a very special anniversary party. In this time of climate crises, reconsider the world around you and experience how environment is everywhere with the Environmental Film Festival 2025. Tickets on sale now at environmentalfilms.org.au.
Presented by Environmental Films Australia, a 3CR supporter.
All right, it is 8:26 in the morning on Thursday Breakfast, and we just have an update, breaking news from Mbantwa, Alice Springs, where in response to the genocide in Palestine, protesters have as of now blocked the road to Pine Gap, that is Hat Road, and protesters are calling for support and more people, to bring water and other supplies. It's important to keep an eye on this developing story. So again, protesters have blocked the road to Pine Gap, that is Hat Road, and Pine Gap is a signals intelligence hub that is complicit in the genocide in Gaza, but also in a whole lot of military and surveillance operations between the Five Eyes countries, and Australia is part of the Five Eyes alliance. So to find out more, you can head to Mbantwa for Palestine on Insta. That is at MPARNTWE_FOR_FALASTIN. You can also follow them on Facebook. Now, we are going to do a very quick recap of what we had on our show today. So I will throw it to you, Alice.
Sure. First up, we had a interview between Giselle and James from the Asia Pacific Currents show last week with researcher and journalist Nick McClellan, and they were discussing the Puk-Puk Treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea.
Then we had Mursal Sadat, captain of the Afghan women's refugee football team. We talked about the upcoming match in the UAE, and they talked how the football is important for Afghan women and their messages of courage, equality, and ongoing fight for Afghan women's rights.
Amazing. And then after that, we were joined by Dave Sweeney, who is one of the co-founders of ICAN and current nuclear-free campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation, to talk about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and progress in the campaign to get Australia to sign and ratify. And finally, you just heard a wonderful interview between Inez and Akshay Gouri, who is maker of the short film Sister Mine. Now, really recommend that folks check out Sister Mine. Thanks again to Inez for the really important and comprehensive recap of the caste system at the beginning of that discussion. And it's something that we really don't hear enough about. So power to folks that are shining a light on this system that really controls and dominates people's lives, especially women's lives in Punjab, and also, across the South Asian diaspora. And That is all we've got time for you today, but thank you so much for joining us on 3CR. We will catch you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.